So much of our socialization, so many good memories are made around tables where we sit and eat with the people we love. Family traditions are made around kitchen tables, and family health can be ruined by those same traditions. Let's be honest, comfort food may be good for the soul, but it can be terrible for the arteries. Today's guests realize that about their own family food traditions. Alice Randall and Caroline Randall-Williams reworked some of the family recipes for their book, Soul Food Love. Healthy recipes inspired by 100 years of cooking in a black family. Alice Randall is a novelist several times over with The Wind Done Gone among her titles. She wears many hats, including as country music writer. She wrote Trisha Yearwood's X's and O's. Alice also teaches a course at Vanderbilt University in Nashville on soul food in text as text. Daughter and co-author Caroline Randall-Williams is a published poet, Harvard graduate, and MFA student at the University of Mississippi. Welcome to Alice.
Hello. It's so great to be with you.
So good to have you. And Caroline, welcome to you as well.
Good morning.
So Alice, let's start with you. I wanted to get this story first. You got credit at Harvard yourself for studying with Julia Child?
Yes. I was that nerdy little child that started off watching Julia Child's first PBS TV show about food and cooking when I was very little, you know, 6, 7, 8. And then when I arrived at Harvard, one of the things I wanted to do was to get in touch with Miss Child. I looked her up in the telephone book, called her, and got to work with her for a semester one-on-one for credit at Harvard.
Go ahead. Did
we focused on the meal of high tea in America and why it disappeared, and I got to spend great time in the Schlesinger cookbook library. And so that was sort of the beginning of my written work with food.
So you get right down to business in the book. I mean, in the first sentence of the preface, there's a clear indication of what eating soul food prepared from traditional recipes has done to the women in your family. Give us some sense of that, Alice.
Well, I got to being over 225 pounds, and when I did, I was following my great-grandmother, my grandmother. I was following the tradition of women in the family. So we looked at, the book is a lot about how 3 or 4 generations of women got to be way over 200 pounds, and how the next generation, Caroline, decided she would never be up to 200 pounds, that she would be a fit woman. So it's a series of love letters, we like to say, love letters to those great big women in our family that went before us, our foremothers, but it's also a series of love letters in the terms of Caroline's recipes, which were love letters to me that would allow me to have a healthier, better life. And I went from being way over 225 pounds to being significantly under 200 pounds.
So, Caroline, did you broach this subject? Did your mom bring it up first? I'm just curious how the conversation developed and how long it took before you guys ended up turning it into this project.
Well, I love that you asked me that question. I think, because it's a question that's resonant for a lot of young people as they think about their parents and their parents' health and all of that. As Mom has said, I was raised around a lot of, you know, really beautiful, dynamic, big black women. And so I never wanted to raise the subject to criticize. But when she told me that she was interested in losing weight, I cannot tell you how relieved I was. And then it sort of put everything in motion almost immediately, because I said, well, I can write you this recipe, and I cook this for myself, and do you want to try this, and can I cook this for you? And I was so excited to engage with her and her pursuit of a healthy body. So I didn't push it at first, but I was so excited when she decided.
So it's not like you were really ready to go. I mean, when she said, you know, yeah, let's do this.
I was very ready. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Caroline's father had died at a young age, and it wasn't obesity related directly, but it might have been compounded with an allergic situation at 45. He was a lawyer. And so she was aware of the fact, as was I, which started me on my journey, that 1 in every 4 middle-aged black women has diabetes, and that obesity can causes fat-fueled cancers, as well as stroke, hypertension, heart attack, these direct things that we see. And so I didn't lose weight. This cookbook is about cooking our way into life. And as Caroline said, she knew her great-grandmother, Alberta, grandma in the book, and she knew Nana, her grandmother, and she, of course, knows her mother. So Caroline knew 3 generations of large, very successful black women, but who had encountered health risk in their own life. And so it was something she really wanted to help me go a new way. So I started off on the exercise and the sleeping on my own, and then she kicked it up with the wonderful food, because initially I thought this would be my journey to health would be a journey of food deprivation. And with Caroline's help, it turned into putting health and history on a plate, a tasty soul food plate. And that was the big, wonderful surprise, that you can get health and history on the plate, that you can stay connected to your soul food past and have a new health future.
But when you talk about food deprivation, it sounds like there might have been a few dragging feet as you first approached this project.
Oh, absolutely. And it will always be a struggle for me. Like for many Black women, the first part of our book is the history of these four kitchens: Grandma's kitchen, Dear's kitchen, Nana's kitchen, my kitchen. And in, when we go through those histories, we look at two very big and complicated things for Black women in the South particularly. And that is, one, the history of kitchen rape. That in 1900, a large percentage of Black women working outside of their homes, off farms, were working as domestic servants, perhaps 90% of that population. And kitchen rape was a real reality and a liability of those jobs. That's after slavery. And, of course, we had kitchen rapes in slavery. The year that Deer started her kitchen in Selma, Alabama, 1913, right down the road in Alabama, a Black woman was lynched. And a lot of your listeners are in Oregon and California. And often in these areas, when we think of groves and we think of trees and we think of healthy food and the pears and the avocados, all apples, all the things that grow on trees, we don't think of bodies hanging from the trees in Oregon. But in Alabama, in Georgia, in Tennessee, in Arkansas, if you are a Black woman and you see fruit hanging from the tree, the fruit also reminds you of bodies hanging from the tree. And so the farm is not a safe space for a lot of Black women.
No, which explains why Deer and her husband ended up in Detroit. We'll talk about the family history and get the family tree cleared up a little bit as we move forward in the conversation with Alice Randall and Caroline Randall Williams, mother and daughter, co-authors of Soul Food Love. We'll come back and talk with the two of them and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Reinley. Thank you for listening. Our guests today are Alice Randall and Caroline Randall Williams, mother and daughter, co-authors of the book Soul Food Love, Healthy Recipes Inspired by 100 Years of Cooking in a Black Family. Our guests are both Harvard graduates and authors and so much more, and also both determined not to die young because of the foods they've been eating. They reworked the family recipes, turned soul food into something a bit healthier, with recipes and a great history lesson in the book as well. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 throughout the listening area, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. So I want to talk about the family tree a little bit, Alice and Caroline, because it does bounce around a bit. Deer, who we mentioned already, is Alice, your grandmother, your father's mother, in Detroit. We also then have Nana on the other side, which is...
we have Grandma on the other side.
Grandma, that's right. Okay, Grandma, then Nana, then you, Mama, and then Caroline, a baby girl. So four generations of three generations, I guess. Okay, four. Wow, hard to count on the fly, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you think about them as Caroline's relations, she has two great-grandmothers in this book, a grandmother and a mother, and then Caroline. So that makes it sort of simple. Two great-grandmothers, a grandmother, and a mother.
Two things I wanted to get into here. One was in discussing the fact that in Oregon and California, yes, it's true we're far from lynching, but the fact is that, sad to say, parts of southern Oregon were quite hotbeds of Klan activity. In fact, so was the Oregon State Legislature in the 1920s. So there is some of that that history here as well.
Mm-hmm.
But not the same level of fear that clearly drove Deer and Pawpaw to move from Selma to Detroit in, what was it, the 20s or earlier than that?
In the 30s, and that's part of that great migration. I mean, that it, but we haven't connected it to our foodways. And we have to notice the last piece of that is that when they got to Detroit, that they loved and prized foods, including TV dinners and Tang, industrial food, because they associated it with being able to vote. They associated it with safety. And so one of the things that Caroline has faced, the challenge of of having a reunion with the Black kitchen, a reunion with the kitchen that is not haunted, creating a kitchen that is not haunted by the specter of domestic service, growing things on her back terrace, starting gardens that honor the history of knowing that we've been exposed to lynching and terrorism in the rural environment, but claiming that space today in the 21st century as a safe space for herself.
And so, Caroline, what do you remember growing up about food traditions in the house and the various houses of relatives you visited?
Well, I mean, it's a pretty wonderful mix of kitchen environments that I had, because I had my great-grandmother and my grandmother, who I used to go and see basically every Sunday growing up. And, you know, my great-grandmother was, in her day, this incredible hostess, you know, with the iron lace doilies and the silver wire baskets and the sort of beautiful multiple layered cakes that, you know, she would do all these extraordinary things. And on the other side, we had her daughter, Joan, my grandmother, and she loved to make, she'd make, like, you know, pimento cheese balls and all sorts of, you know, bourbon things, like bar snacks, because her husband was this, you know, civil rights lawyer. And so people were always coming in and out of their house and throwing ideas around and, you know, discussing what was going on in Nashville. And in my mother's kitchen, my mother and I, she raised me going out to a lot of really good restaurants. And when she did cook, it was always, you know, for some big elaborate event. And it was some fabulous, you know, probably more inspired by her Julia Child encounters than by, you know, her encounters with Southern cooking. And they would be these fabulous, complicated meals that would take days. And they were, and it, when Mom got in the kitchen when I was growing up, it was usually a big to-do. It was a special event. And so I didn't have a sense of, you know, day in, day out healthy cooking that was created by women that I knew and loved and was related to in my house. But I had a very magical sense of what food in the house could be.
So, Alice, as you were raising Caroline, how busy were you in the kitchen? It sounds like you were very busy with your career.
No, I did not do a lot of day-to-day cooking in my kitchen. In fact, one of the things I talk about in the book is that I hired a succession of white hippie cooks. That was part of my upturning, the narrative that got me fat on a variety of hummus and vegan food. That is, if you can, it's that I did not get fat eating junk food. And I like to say that Black women are not fat because we're lazy, we're fat because we're exhausted, because I was eating relatively healthy food. It wasn't necessarily soul food, but healthy food, because I was very concerned to feed Caroline healthy food. That there were cookies in the house, but they would be homemade cookies. We would have waffles, but they would be something that were yeast raised and had been worked on for 2 days. But as Caroline said, we ate out a lot. We always ate together, but it would not have been uncommon in her childhood if we had dinner out 3 or 4 nights a week in some interesting restaurant or home with, as I said, the series of hippie cooks making interesting, elaborate things. And it wasn't until Caroline moved down to the Mississippi Delta, I turned around, it was 225 pounds, and we said, this has got to stop. And in Mississippi, Caroline started cooking every day, you know, for herself on a daily basis, frequently, and providing everyday meals on a budget, on the quick, on the cheap.
So, Caroline, the stuff that the white hippie cooks made, was this the kind of stuff you, I mean, do you remember fondly, or did you roll your eyes and head out for a Twinkie and a cheeseburger every chance you got?
Well, you know, and it was what I knew. So, I'm as fond of a sort of vegan, you know, pesto, hummus, something or other as the next hippie girl, you know, there's definitely a place for that in my heart. And I look back on it with great fondness, actually.
And one of the things we want to put on the record is that one of the things we discovered writing this book, Soul Food Love, is, and researching both in our family history and other families, but our family, is that there are a lot of very healthy Black historical soul foods that really cross with what I was doing with the hippie cooks. The sweet potato, the peanut, the red snapper, the sardines, collard greens, turnip greens. All of these are part of Black foodways, that when you actually think about an enslaved person cooking for themselves, a person, a slave owner, knew how many cows or chickens they owned. They didn't know how many fish were in the streams or the ponds. And so actually, we have lots of documentation that black people, women and men, would go fish in the dark, literally, with their hands or with tools that they made, and they would get fish for their family and maybe gather wild berries. And that would be a private feast that an enslaved family could have for a day that was special for them, or if they wanted to add to what they have been given. And we know this from the archaeological record. We find actually fish bones, berry seeds, pits in the archaeology of the slave quarters. And so what's really the most historical black meal we probably have in America is baked fish in a fire and wild berries. That's really healthy. And Caroline has revisited that in her George's Red Snapper recipe and in some of these wonderful, the New South fruit salad that has watermelon and avocado and tomato in it. These are celebrations, as well as the resurrection salad that has the fruit in it, that wild fruit we might have found. These are celebrations of traditional African-American foodways. We haven't always been eating fried chicken. Fried chicken is really part of a much later industrial food, which we call sort of industrial greed food, that was introduced in the 50s and the 60s.
It sounds similar to the phenomenon of the so-called Indian fry bread that's served at a lot of county fairs and that sort of thing, which most Native Americans go, what?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Well, just think about it. Mm-hmm. If you were an enslaved person, would you have a stove to sit and fry some chicken on and some extra oil just sitting around? No. You may have been able to stew something slowly and eat vegetables because you could pick them and eat them raw. Often they're actually many enslaved people had gardens that was part of their job, was to raise vegetables for the entire plantation and to supplement. They were made to supplement their own food rations that were given to them. And so we want to make use of the traditional African-American foodways. Some of the great hummus recipes that Caroline has, spinning on the ones that she was brought up with, which were the traditional chickpea and tahini, is taking a page out of George Washington Carver's book. She's got a black eyed pea and peanut butter hummus that I just adore.
There's some great stuff in here. We'll get to the recipes in a couple of minutes. We're talking to Alice Randall and Caroline Randall Williams, mother and daughter, authors of Soul Food Love, Healthy Recipes Inspired by 100 Years of Cooking in a Black Family. You can join the discussion on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760, by email jx@jeffnet.org. I want to go back in the history lesson just a little bit, Alice, because you mentioned already about your grandmother, Dear, in Detroit, embracing Tang and TV dinners and stuff like that. Part of that was not just in reaching out to that, but leaving farm food behind. I mean, you mentioned in the book, she really had a thing about farm food, didn't she?
Yes, she wanted to leave it behind because when she was living on a farm, she could not vote. Her family was in peril of losing their lives. And in fact, she didn't get to spend her family farm. She didn't really get to spend much time on it because her actual father was a white man, a prominent white man in the community, and her quote-unquote black father was not her actual father. The Deer was, rose from one of these complicated situations that we have in the South. And so she was alienated from the farm also on a psychological level, that she was largely raised by her black grandmother, who continued to work as a domestic servant, when her mother actually had a farm with her black husband. But her daughter, Dear, was actually the product of a relationship between an encounter of a prominent white man and a black woman. So Dear had very complicated feelings about family farms. And she also was a person who self-medicated with sugar.
Big time. In fact, one of the first things you mention in the book is the dress box apples.
Exactly, which is one of the few things that Dear did cook, and she cooked for me, which from the days when dresses did come in dress boxes, it might be 2-3 dozen apples that were cooked in sugar water and dyed a surreal color, such as blue or bright green, purple. And Dear would give me this, lavish me with this gift of both her imagination and gift of sugar, But sugar, she really perceived as compensation for loss and compensation for the bitterness of life in the South for Black people and difficulties in general for Black people in America. Deer compensated for those losses and pains with, and self-medicated with the one drug she had, and that was sugar.
Sugar in large amounts, as you point out. In fact, sugar tit. Why don't we talk about sugar tit?
Well, I say that the sugar tit is the saddest recipe in the soul food canon. And basically, now that is not a recipe from actual slavery days when sugar was kept under lock and key. But it is a recipe from the time in which people went into domestic service and often had to leave their own children behind. And so mothers could not breastfeed their own children because they're off working somewhere else. And so would soak a handkerchief, a clean handkerchief, in sugar water and give that to a child to suck on while they were gone. And so a sugar tit that, you know, is evidence of the absence of the mother, feeding the kid empty calories that are rotting the teeth. What a tragic recipe. But at the same time, what an effort on a mother to try to be in two places at one time, to do the impossible. And Deer raised, you know, five children, and she has grandchildren and great-grandchildren have gone to Harvard and MIT and are doctors, and she herself did live into her late 70s. So I can't judge her harshly or wrong. She did the best she could with what she had. And that's, there's an old Black Creole saying, don't forget the bridge that brought you over. And the sugar tit, as much as I don't want to take it in the future, I know my father sucked on them. And that's the bridge that brought me over, and we want to honor it and then move on to a new bridge.
Alice Randall and Caroline Randall Williams are our guests on the Jefferson Exchange. Their book is Soul Food Love. I want to talk about, go to the other side of the family then. We're talking about your former husband's grandma, identified as Grandma Alberta Johnson, and help me with the last name pronunciation.
Bontemps.
Okay, it is the French way. You say in the book, is a great, great phrase here, that she and people like her cooked up a Black bourgeois bubble. What does that mean?
Grandma Bontemps, and Caroline can probably tell you even more about this, but she was, her husband was a librarian at a university. She was part of a Black academic club society that many people have forgotten. All through the South, there were Black colleges and universities, more back in the day than there are now during segregation. And so Grandma was living on a Black college campus and was living with Black professors and doctors and lawyers and teachers, as well as everyday working people. But her immediate environment was a very bourgeois environment of a world of Black professors, lawyers, and doctors and teachers, and a lot of doctors in Nashville because Meharry Medical College was there. And so because of segregation, these women at that time couldn't, and their families could not go into many or almost any public restaurants. And if they wanted to eat out, they had to eat in other Black women's homes. And so they formed many, many clubs. Sometimes you could be in a club for every day of the week, and they would go turn their homes into essentially restaurants, and they could go into other women's homes for their socialization. And so that's what I mean by that Black bourgeois bubble. It's a little bit removed from, but never completely removed from, the underclass, often committed to trying to help and support the underclass, but also forming a world of their own, where, as I also say, that Grandma tried to create acts of civil realignment with her meals, where the men were going out and working politically in an overt way. She was saying with her meal, you are worthy, you are equal, I am imaginative, I have agency, I am not limited by the world that is trying to limit me.
Now, Caroline, you mentioned this grandmother before and talked about the elaborateness of the meals. I mean, this was really a project to make a meal for a club meeting.
Oh, absolutely. And she was just she's the kind of woman that doesn't quite exist anymore, I don't think, in terms of her commitment to doing everything just so. I mean, this is a woman who you go into her living room and, you know, the sleeves of the couches would be pinned on with these beautiful pearl-tipped pins and, you know, like the immaculate flower arrangements at every turn, and her food was also it was executed in such a way as well, which is what made it so fabulous to go over there. But she was really somebody for whom, you know, the courses, the presentation, the experience, and the pride she took in laying out a table and in executing a dish was really quite extraordinary.
Now, she apparently brought some vegetarian recipes into the family cookery. Where did
she
those come from?
Well, she was a Seventh-day Adventist. She was raised a Seventh-day Adventist. And, you know, the Seventh-day Adventist is one of the biggest black vegetarian movements that exists historically in this country. And, you know, there was the Seventh-day Adventist newsletter that used to circulate widely throughout the South. There used to be tons of vegetarian recipes. And we have one in the cookbook in honor of this tradition called the Oakwood Bean Loaf that we're really proud of. And is inspired by their time. My great-grandmother and my great-grandfather spent some time at Oakwood University, which is just outside of Huntsville, Alabama, and is a Seventh-day Adventist, historically black university. And we have loved being, and that's one of our favorite intersections of the history together with the family, the larger collective black cultural history together with the food. And so the vegetarian movement is something that we've had a really good time being able to highlight and to put forward as part of the soul food history that already belongs to us.
Much more to talk about Soul Food Love by Alice Randall and Caroline Randall Williams, back on the Jefferson Exchange with them, and your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guests today are Alice Randall and Caroline Randall Williams, both Harvard graduates, both published authors, and so much more. Now the authors together of a book called Soul Food Love, Healthy Recipes Inspired by 100 Years of Cooking in a Black Family. You get the 100 years of the family, and then you get the recipes, and it's a wonderful blend. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760. Emails go to jx@jeffnet.org. Alice, in the chapter on Grandma, Alberta Johnson Bontemps, you write of the black women expecting to get big. Was it something of status? Was that part of it?
Well, certainly many of them, there's a phrase, big is three houses or big is two houses, and Grandma Bontemps, which is said with pride, and Grandma Bontemps would refer to the time she said, when I was in my prime, I weighed over 200 pounds. So she associated getting smaller, turning into a size 16 or 18, with getting old and ill. She said, in my prime. Now, Grandma Bontemps, who spent most of her life over 200 pounds, also could flip mattresses, king-size mattresses, in her house to within the weeks, if not months, that she died, and was living in her house, not in assisted living, and flipping mattresses, you know, well over 95 years old. And so there is some interest in this. So this size and the stature, she associated with both physical power, social power, and it wasn't the only model in her community, but it was a prominent model.
All right, I want to talk about Nana now, her daughter, Joan, and her husband. I mean, Avon Williams Jr. himself is a big deal, but then Joan had this amazing cookbook collection. Tell us about that, Caroline.
Well, you know, a lot of, you know, when my grandmother passed, I got boxes and boxes of books arrived at my childhood home when my grandmother passed away. And we started unwrapping them and realizing that Nana had left me all of her cookbooks. And, you know, I'd grown up sort of running my hands over them and peering at them in her house. And then to all of a sudden see them in my house and realize that that was my inheritance from her, having known how important they were to her, was pretty extraordinary for me. And I think it engendered in me from, you know, as early an age as I could read the titles, that the food that my family liked and was interested in was always going to be, you know, multicultural and from the high and the low and from the local and from the past and from, you know, the other side of the world. And so I've always felt the cookbooks really were a way from, they began my culinary education so early. And they also are my inheritance from my grandmother, which is a pretty extraordinary thing to think that she passed me something that works for me on an intellectual level, on an emotional level, and then also has this like incredible material presence in my life.
Carolyn, tell them how many cookbooks it is. They won't be
expecting
it. Oh,
my God. It's what I take it for granted that it's such an astonishing. It's nearly 2,000 cookbooks that she left me. And people say, well, how do you keep them all? And what I will say is that we have this wonderful kitchen in the house I grew up in that runs the length of our house, and almost all the wall space is taken up with my cookbook collection.
Wow. That's
and it doesn't even fit the whole thing.
No, it doesn't.
That's crazy. Well, let's talk about kitchens then, because you talk, Alice, about the search for Diddy Wah Diddy. What is that?
Well, that's the mythical perfect food place. In the traditional black folklore of America, Diddy Wah Diddy is a place where the chickens run around with the forks and knives already in their backs, where food is extremely convenient and in extraordinary abundance. And I think that Caroline created a new Diddy Wah Diddy for me, where the food is extremely healthy and also incredibly tasty. And it may not be quite as convenient, but it's more wondrous, and it's convenient enough. So Diddy Wah Diddy, it's not that elaborate, crazy, wonderful food of my Julia Child dreams. It is, you know, Caroline, in our Diddy Wah Diddy, you can open a can of sardines, squeeze some lemon, or put a shot of Louisiana hot sauce on it and eat that out of the can. And that's good for the environment, and that's good for your body, and that's eating the very same snack Alberta Bonnetant ate as a little black girl in Waycross, Georgia.
Let's take a call. We have Mark in Reading on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Alice Randall and Caroline Randall Williams, the authors of Soul Food Love.
Yes, good morning. My understanding is that soul food started as what people were allowed to eat and what they could find rather than what they may have wanted to eat. And this continued on. I read many years ago, read the book Black Like Me, and one of the things I remember from it was the author talking to a woman in a little cafe, and she said, oh, yes, we have wingtip soup. That was what they had, you know, the tips of chicken wings. They didn't get any other parts of the chicken, just the tips of the wings.
Nothing meatier. Okay.
And that's the kind of thing that I'm wondering if that kind of thing, when things got easier, if people started eating the fried food because that was what they wanted and they couldn't get.
Okay. Thanks for that, Mark. Appreciate it. Alice, you want to take a stab at that?
Well, there are people who talk about soul food as remnant food, that it is what was left over, master's leavings, and there is some truth to that, but that is not the only truth because, for example, sweet potatoes, which are central to the African-American diet, are something, sweet potatoes or yams were eaten commonly in Africa. They were eaten in the Middle Passage, and they were a staple here. So that's an example of a food that black people had a preference for and were able to continue with from Africa to the New World. And there are other examples. And that it is actually somewhat of an African tradition in certain cultures. Africa is a continent with many different food cultures. But to use the whole animal and honoring the whole animal by using the whole animal, much as many fancy chefs do today. And we see the pig foot, for example, also appears in French food. So that idea that black food was made up of only throwaway food that nobody wanted is only partially true, and it doesn't tell the whole story. It does tell a part of the story. There have been complexities, but we like to, when you think about the sweet potato, the peanut, the okra, the sesame seed, the okra and the sesame seed are actually plants that came from Africa that were brought to the New World, and Africans actually introduced this to the Europeans, and they become very important sources of the sesame seed, of oil. Thomas Jefferson was really fascinated by them, and protein. That it's not just the case that African-American food is remnant food. It has a lot of innovation and a lot of health in it, and it's only when it got sort of assaulted by the industrial food complex that we see this sort of fried food. And there's some of them may be aspirational foods to end up with that fried chicken and biscuits, things that black domestic servants were cooking for in homes where they worked. There may have been a movement when prosperity came to put those foods in their own homes. That is a real impulse, perhaps, for some.
Well, very early in the book, you write about abundance became excess, and this was about in Deer's house in Detroit, your dad's mom. And I was surprised to find that there were two meats on Sunday.
Well, they were successful, striving black people in Detroit with the rise of Motown Records, the rise of labor unions. They were able to have that prosperity, and steak meant a lot to them. And so there is that aspirational aspect. But what's interesting is because steak was a food that also did exist for, say, wealthy whites in the South, and they knew of that, they were much more fascinated by something like the TV dinner that they had never seen before, that they associated with pure modernity.
Coming back to your Diddy Wah Diddy, your kitchen in Nashville, it sounds like a really busy place, and I'm just curious about the statement that you have fed both Tea Party activists and people from Move On in that kitchen.
That is absolutely true on the very simplest level. We are friends with Marsha Blackburn, who is very, you know, in the right wing of the Republican Party, and we're friends with Congresswoman Jim Cooper, who's a Democrat, who some people consider to be the smartest person in the Congress. We are very interested in the common ground of Americans and solving our serious, real common problems, such as the fact that diabetes is a $174 billion a year problem right now for America, hitting whites, Asians, blacks, hitting Hispanics, hitting the Native American population, hitting all populations in $174 billion. Anyone who's paying taxes needs to be concerned about food reform and needs to be concerned with moving beyond shaming and blaming to healthy, happy eating for everybody.
And that wraps up a lot of different issues like farm policy and health care reform and just all the different areas that come together. And they all start in the kitchen. What do you know?
Yes, I said the kitchen sink Amazons will fix it, because the fact of the matter is there's no form of health care that we can offer in America, whether you believe in Obamacare or you don't believe in Obamacare, at $174 billion a year spent on diabetes-related illness alone. That won't work for the American economy. We have to change. And what we focus on is, so Caroline's cookbook, our cookbook, her recipes, Soul Food Love, you could cook it on SNAP if you had to, which is the old food stamps. These are easy, cheap, tasty recipes that connect us to the whole American experience, because the African American experience is the American experience, because Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, their food cultures and their understanding what freedom was were all informed by the experience of the Africans they enslaved and knew. And so this is an American project. Everybody thinks they love fried chicken. We want everybody to love Caroline's roasted hot chicken.
All right, so Caroline, that's a great send-off into the recipe section of the book, which is really the back two-thirds of the book. The history section so fast, and you can spend days and days in there. Is there a quintessential recipe? Is there one soul food dish that you really felt like you had to make over and that you might have had some trepidation about doing changes to?
Oh, gosh. I really, for the most part, steered away from the making over of dishes in favor of reviving old ones.
Mm-hmm.
I would say my favorite one that I did revive, or that I did make over, was the breakfast casseroles, because that's not something that we'd often done at celebratory meals for me growing up, the traditional one with, you know, the pork sausage and the grits and all of the, bags and bags of cheddar cheese. And my breakfast casserole is really beautiful, and it's got, you know, fresh vegetables in it and egg whites and turkey sausage and, you know, and tons of delicious spices. You know, there's chili flakes and oregano and chili powder and cayenne and all of that. It's just a really fun dish. So I'm really proud of the making over that I did of the breakfast casserole. And maybe the fruit salad that my mom talks about as well, the new school fruit salad, reminding people that avocados and tomatoes are also fruit, and that can be a really fun, healthy alternative to the fruit cocktail that we find so egregiously, you know, plopped onto plates all through Southern lunch rooms.
With the marshmallows and everything?
Uh-huh, exactly.
And notice you mentioned turkey just now, and there is a recipe in here I saw for turkey burgers, which I have stopped buying ground turkey because all I get is faces at home when I say turkey burgers. Oh, really?
I love my turkey burgers. I actually just ate one for dinner last night. You know, it's, again, it's all about getting about having fun with your spice cabinet, which is something that I really encourage people to do because I think that so many of us forget that flavor can come from, you know, blending spices well instead of from, you know, adding lots of salt and fat. So a turkey burger that you know, if you put in some cinnamon and nutmeg and a little bit of heat in there and, you know, a little bit of olive oil and, you know, you can really make a turkey burger sing even more dynamically than a regular burger. I promise.
We talked about the Nashville kitchen, the Diddy Wah Diddy. You're in Oxford, Mississippi now, is that right?
I am in Oxford, Mississippi right now. That's right.
And what do you have for a kitchen there?
Oh, I have this cute little house that was actually built as a little throwaway house that then got relocated to Oxford when they were going to tear it down for the Tennessee Valley Authority project back in the between the two world wars. And so it's a funny little old house, and it's sort of falling down, but it's in the middle of town, and my kitchen has an awesome gas range and black and white checkered floor, and I've got, you know, all sorts of knickknacks in every nook and cranny of it, and it's always got my staple things sort of sitting out in a big bowl, which is, you know, sweet potatoes, onions, lemons, garlic, the things that you need to get any good meal going around here.
We've given really short shrift to the recipes, but they really are wonderful. The whole book is just a joy to read. Soul Food Love, Healthy Recipes Inspired by 100 Years of Cooking in a Black Family. Caroline Randall Williams and Alice Randall, thank you both so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.
We love being with you all.
All right, take care.